Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning and welcome morning. To Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms and we play some really cool music as well. So we like to think. You got Julian Paul here live. Later in this hour, I'll be talking to our PG as well. And this week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Dr. Ogur Osamor. He's back from his summer recess. And all being well, he's going to be talking about the London Ultra Low Emission Zone 3 years on. Yes, controversially it was when it was expanded. All good stuff. All being well, next week and indeed every third Saturday of the month, Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society, will be back with us. He's also been on his summer recess. All good stuff. Before we go any further, must remind you to record or watch The Sky at Night this Monday, the 14th of September. It's on at 10 o'clock on BBC 4, but of course you can watch on iPlayer. Part of that was filmed at Mexburton Swinton Astronomical Society Observatory, the J.A. Jones Observatory, and that's based at Hoover Stand near Wentworth. None of the members of the Mexburton Swinton Astronomical Society are featured in the film. They had to hide away, but what an honour for national TV to come to their observatory. So well done to them. And also a reminder that, again, for the Mexburton Swinton Astronomical Society, they're involved in the RSPB Batwalk and MSAS Night Sky event on Friday the 18th of September. So that's next Friday, and that's from about 4:30 till 7 p.m. Booking is essential via the RSPB All More website. Tickets range from £9 to £19. So join the team at Oldmoor and Mexburton Swinton Astronomical Society for an evening of natural spectacle. Come on a guided walk to see the birds coming into roost at sunset, and then as the skies darken, lift your gaze skywards as the stars come out. The evening will start with a choice of guided walk to the RSPB Hides to watch the elusive bittern settling down in the reed beds. You may even see barn owls returning to their nests. And following the walks, Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society will be on hand to show you the wonders of the night sky through their powerful telescopes. In the classroom, there will be an amazing presentation of film footage of the stars as well. And in the visitor centre there, there will be a demonstration of a planetarium to show you the wider planetary systems. And up in the RSPB cafe, soup and hot drinks will be available to warm you up. All good stuff, eh? So also, we're moving on now. What's been in the science news this week?
Well, this gets... keeps coming in more and more. Right, OpenAI's chief scientist Jacob Pachocki has called for extreme caution over AI's runaway progress and warned more intervention may be needed to ensure humans remain in control of the future.
Ooh.
In a blog post entitled An Alien Mind, he wrote, "I am concerned no one is prepared for the consequences of a continued rapid rise in machine intelligence." His blog post came only a few days after the ChatGPT maker released its latest model, GPT-6 Astra, which it calls its most powerful product ever. OpenAI and other AI firms like Anthropic have already shared reports of their AI agents actually autonomously and carrying out real-world cyber attacks on other companies.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Another interesting story in the press was about a drug trial for Alzheimer's prevention. Middle-aged people with no memory loss will be offered an Alzheimer's drug in a trial expected to bring significant hope to the battle against dementia. Early research suggested that the treatment, trontinemab, could clear toxic brain plaques after 3 months late infusion. Scientists want to see if it can stop the disease before symptoms start. People aged 55 or older who have no memory problems will be screened for early signs of the disease. For those who have TAU protein levels which fall in a specific range, which is a marker of Alzheimer's, will be offered a spot on the international study. Professor Ramin Nifurushan, who's chief investigator for the PreventTron trial, said it could mark a shift from treating cognitive decline to preventing it. For decades, researchers focused on treating Alzheimer's disease after symptoms appear. PreventTron addresses a different question, whether we can act earlier. The trial will begin at Surrey and Border NHS Foundation Trust on Monday. I think I got this out of the press last week, so it might have already started. And more than 15 hospitals and clinics are expected to participate by the end of this year. About 1,600 healthy adults aged between 55 and 80 will be selected internationally for the 4 to 6 year trial. Scientists hope the drug could be used alongside the P-TAU217 blood test as a preventative for high-risk individuals as early as midlife. Now, trontinemab, developed by the Swiss company Roche, targets amyloid, the sticky protein that builds up in organs and tissues to cause damage. This trial marks the third phase of a study after the previous two suggested the drug could remove amyloid buildups quicker than previous treatments. Other drugs such as lecanemab and donanemab typically take a year to clear plaque levels, which trontinemab can remove in 3 months. Very interesting, eh?
Yes, this is a story from the Metro from our friend Steve Roden from Monday, the 7th of September. Touching 3D baby model lets blind parents feel scan. Baby scans are being transformed into 3D printed models so parents and grandparents with sight loss can visualise the new child. First LO, set up by the charity Guide Dogs, turns a traditional ultrasound picture taken at 20 weeks into a tactile sonogram which users can read with their fingers. Sophie and Reese Finnegan-Knight are expecting their first child this year. Reese, who has a visual impairment, said, "Holding the tactile scan for the very first time was an incredible experience. I found it really hard thinking friends and family knew more about my baby, about my baby than I did. First hello gave the moments back to me. Around 50 molds will be made in an initial pilot after the charity found 54% of adults felt standard scans could be more inclusive. Guide Dogs said people with sight loss are often excluded from significant life moments, including pregnancy milestones."
Interesting. Another story from Mr. Roden, courtesy of the Metro, I believe. Laughter really is the best medicine, lung trial proves. And this said that laughter, it really is the best medicine because laughter therapy could ease breathing issues for those suffering with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or COPD. A study has found a good chuckle may promote deeper exhalation, Dr. Kongajul Alden said. Her team conducted a trial with 63 sufferers at Ankara Hospital in Turkey. They enjoyed 3 30-minute sessions a week and found it easier to breathe a month after the trial. And that's that news was received by the European Respiratory Society Congress. Up to 1.7 million people in the UK live with COPD. Interesting.
Yeah. Ken Dodd, he made you laugh, didn't he?
He did, yeah. All good stuff. And finally, before we speak to RPG, the human habit of walking with a heel strike gait, where our heels meet the floor first with each step before the rest of the foot follows, gave our species the energy to stride all over the face of the planet, a new study has found. It also led us to develop thicker bones and joints, making us more robust and better able to survive. Who knew? Aerosmith there, Walk This Way, and we played that because we were talking about the fact that we walk with a heel strike gait may mean that's why we could roam the world and make a stronger species. All good stuff. You listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then?
Well, there's a bit that you've touched on already. Artificial intelligence seems to keep coming up to the fore. And I just sort of, a couple of tangents of that was going back to the start of what use we're making of artificial intelligence. And I think that you don't always realise, but I think previously it's been used for language translation, image recognition and decision making, credit scoring, e-commerce. And in the 2020s, there was a big advance called generative AI, and that really comes from 2017, the appearance of a transformer model architecture that generative AI was using, and that gave it the ability to create text, images, voice, music, videos, and other forms of data from chat-based prompting. So it's used in agriculture, really, for trying to increase yields and classification of livestock, automation of things like greenhouses, the detection of diseases and pests, and optimizing irrigation. So you've got the assisted AI software development and the kind of architecture that AI is involved in. It uses that for automation, design and planning, and it's also assisting human skills in the field of architecture. So taking some of the drudgery out of producing some of the information you need for architecture. 2019, there was a study that found generative AI increased productivity by 15% in contact centres. And in 2019, that study found that had increased up to 40% for writing tasks. So we've talked about things like students developing the use of artificial intelligence for essay writing and things, which opens a lot of sort of questions and sort of asks what we can create as our own work and how much of that is created by artificial intelligence. But also the basis of a lot of chatbots around. And again, we've talked about the pros and cons of that with a lot of applications like trying to support people who may be lonely or isolated, and they can chat to a chatbot, which a lot of people say makes them feel better. But also developing software. Again, there's an amount of drudgery involved in coding where you've got to be very detailed, and you can hand a lot of that over to an artificial intelligence piece of software. Neural networks designed, quantum computing, and they really say they developed sort of range of things like time sharing, interactive interpreters, so basically being able to understand a language that you don't speak in real time, graphical user interfaces like the mouse on your computer, rapid application developments of environments, and automatic storage of management. So I thought it really sort of a very, very varied thing, and a lot of time people probably don't realise. We've talked about the voice assistants now. So again, for people with disabilities, Siri and other voice assistants can actually automate processes. So they can actually activate things like lights or switch on the kettle and things by voice, which is sort of another development where it's supporting human beings. Another one where it's driving people mad is the automatic telephone answering services. So basically artificial intelligence will take the precursor for a conversation and say, what area do you want? Who are you trying to contact? What kind of information are you looking for? what do you want to do with that? And at some point it will hand over from itself to a human operator if it can't actually get to the information the person seems to be asking. But it can also have standard responses which maybe satisfies that inquiry. So you've got that one. You've got it used in hospitality. So again, repetitive task, analysing trends, interacting with guests so they can predict what the customer needs. In education, energy, environment, decision making, and early warning systems, so they can be prompted to look out for signs of disasters, things like snowfall, avalanches, and economic and social changes. They can be monitoring also the media, motion interpolation. So a lot of things like we see now with animation. On one side of that thing, there are still entities like Wallace and Gromit, which are hand-done. But on the other side, there's an awful lot of use of artificial intelligence to create cartoons and images, and also special effects in films. And also, sadly, the side issue to that can be the creation of deep fakes, where we see artificial intelligence being used to impersonate a person to get the appearance of them saying something that they didn't actually start out to say. It can also be used in video surveillance for things like facial recognition. And in music, it sort of threatens to take over some of the tasks in the music world. Writing and sports writing, it goes on and on, I think. And the sort of question that started me thinking was, where, I mean, obviously it's based on data and information, but where does artificial intelligence get its information? Obviously, it's a man-made creation, so it's got some kind of guidance as to what it does and where it goes, initially at least. And they say, and this is an article that was on LinkedIn, the sort of business people's website. It's from Deepak Gupta on the 11th of September last year. It's talking about 2025, how artificial intelligence has become so deeply woven into the fabric of our lives. But then asks the question, where does it actually get its information? So he spent years in artificial intelligence, developing things like the Logic Balls AI community and Graka AI, and he was looking at the evolution and the increasing sophistication of artificial intelligence. Real world sort of costs, you can see, is that at that time he was saying that the $8.6 billion economy behind AI. So the AI training data set market had exploded from $2.6 billion in 2024 to a projected $8.6 billion by 2030. And they're saying it's not just growth, it's a fundamental shift in how we think about information as a strategic asset. So nearly 90% of notable AI models in 2024 came from industry rather than from academic sources. And they highlight how data access has become a competitive advantage for a lot of industry and commerce. So where does AI get its information? Well, the top sources in 2025, I was surprised to see that the number one at that time was the site Reddit, and about 40% of the resource use was by searching within Reddit for things that the AI needed to extract. Second one's probably well known to a lot of us. Wikipedia took about 26%. YouTube provided 23.5%. Google, about the same. Yelp was 21%. Facebook, 20%. Amazon, 18.7%. TripAdvisor, down at 12.5%. Mapbox, 11.3%. And the open version of Director Shop is 11.3%. So they're saying that Reddit's the largest single contributor offering community-driven discussions and real-world experiences. So that is the route that the artificial intelligence is taking to find out information and to find trends. Because again, one of the things that you'll see artificial intelligence used for, if you use things like Netflix and online channels, you'll find that they're actually using artificial intelligence to generate those things which say, if you watch this, you'll probably like these films. So it's sort of doing that. Wikipedia is a structured encyclopedic knowledge that's peer moderated, so gives you an idea of what people believe and that there's some fact checking on it. YouTube has got multimedia content, so you've got tutorials on there, don't forget, educational information. So if you're looking for specific sort of information that way, Google gives you the search results and web access. Yelp, consumer reviews and local business. Facebook, social interaction and community content. And Amazon, product reviews and market data. So you can see where AI is being applied and where it's looking for information to assist it in assisting people in those areas. So they're looking at trends from us as consumers and saying, well, okay, if you're searching for this, then what about these products? What about these companies? And I guess some of the problem is that a lot of companies now are, as we said, the bulk of development in artificial intelligence is coming from industry and that side. So it's companies trying to position their company, their products into the marketplace and using that kind of collated information from real-world activity to direct people to their products. Equally, if you're a bad actor in artificial intelligence, like we're just starting to hear about countries that are using artificial intelligence to create false information, and you can see that is something that's really a common fear these days. But the sort of backbone for artificial intelligence training remains to be the automated web crawling. So it looks at projects like Common Crawl, which has collected over 12.8 billion image text pairs since 2014. And that forms a foundation for models like Stable Diffusion and Midjourney. So this is a complete sort of different language. And I think for a lot of people, it's so remote and yet so apparent in things that you probably don't see as artificial intelligence. Things like your washing machine is developing artificial intelligence to select the best temperature and sort of things to do the wash. I say trying to find your favorite places on holiday. Again, it's probably using artificial intelligence in the background to produce it. So It's a big opportunity for the future, but also some very scary side effects that people are sort of starting to find. And it's amazing how it's aggregating that data and using those sort of search fields to create some of the new developments. And you can see that now in things like medicine. You know, we're seeing a lot of predictions for curing various things in a much sort of speedier way through the use of artificial intelligence. So it's quite a sort of a dramatic opportunity, a dramatic change, and I think for a lot of people it illustrates the sort of remoteness from modern technology. And I think that so many countries, I think America wants to be the leading country in the world for artificial intelligence. The UK also wants to jump on that bandwagon. So you're seeing such a massive sort of cultural and practical change coming from artificial intelligence. And that's just some of the routes that you can see where it's picking up its information. So that was what kind of occupied my mind.
just that little topic, Paul, a bit like quantum physics.
I'm speechless.
Just absolutely, you just sort of wonder about it. And I guess just to sign off, the other thing that caught my eye was to say that the El Nino event that's coming across from the Pacific and starting to affect us over here, has caused the hurricane season to be one of the quietest ever. Usually yes. Generates in the Caribbean and comes across the Atlantic to us. So it's saying that's quieter than ever. And that kind of nudged me towards a new film that's coming out. And it's looking at historically the D-Day landings. And James Stagg was a meteorological officer in the RAF, I think he was at the time. And the one arm of meteorology that looked at historic data said that there was no problem for the landings because historically it had been a calm sort of time. And James Stagg came out with looking at data from multiple meteorological stations around the world and came back and said, look, there is going to be a storm covering a couple of days right in the centre of where the D-Day landings were due to occur. And he was called in by Eisenhower, who was planning the invasion, and had to explain to him what his findings were. Eisenhower believed him, and they delayed the D-Day invasion to avoid a couple of days of stormy, difficult weather, which could have really made a gigantic problem for the D-Day landing. So I think it's called Forecast, which is kind of how, again, you know, modern days we're using artificial intelligence to help forecast the weather, but that's going back to show you some of the history of advancements and how critical they can be.
And guess what track you've chosen then? I see now why.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know, it's always great when you've had a bit of a storm and things clear, you can see a bit more clearly. So
you can.
Johnny Nash.
Excellent, Paul. Great stuff. We'll speak to you Monday as well on Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3.
Great. Look forward to
okay,
it.
Okay, Paul. Bye. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye. Bye.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright sunshiny day. It's gonna be bright.
Bit of Johnny Cash there with Whoa. I Can See Clearly. Johnny Nash. Oh, well, not far wrong then. That was I Can See Clearly Now, The Rain Has Gone, because RPG was talking about the new film that's out called Forecast, isn't it? About D-Day landings. Wow. Brilliant stuff. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday we should have Dr. Ogot Osamo on the line. Good morning, Ogu.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to hear your voice, Ogu.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning. To you guys.
We've missed you, Ogu. You've been on your summer recess. You're a busy man.
Yes, indeed. It's been a very busy period of summer, you know. Lovely summer as well.
Oh, I bet you've loved it, all that hot weather.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, great stuff. So, Ogu, for people who don't know, your background is air quality, although actually chemistry is your love, your initial, what you studied. And we knew each other because we worked together in the council's air quality team. But you're going to talk today about the ultra-low emission zone expansion that happened in London. And I can't believe that it was 3 years ago. That's how long has passed.
Very quickly as well.
So, it was controversial at the time.
It was indeed controversial. Lots of people were sceptical and doubted that it was going to do much. But the Mayor of London had the courage, took the decision to implement the ultra-low emission zone in London. The biggest clean air zone ever implemented anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And findings now show huge improvements, about 24% reduction, for example, in the level of air pollution. And the air pollutant that was of particular concern was nitrogen dioxide, or is nitrogen dioxide. It continues to be an issue anyway. And when that decision was taken, people doubted that it was going to do, the ULEZ was going to do very much. Initially, they had a clean air zone, which was based really on the central London area. And they introduced multiplicity of policies, including what was then toxicity charge in 2017. They used to charge £10 daily to, you know, vehicles that were highly polluting. It meant vehicles that were less than, you know, Euro 4 standards. You may remember the Euro
system. I do, yes.
It classified emissions from tailpipe of vehicles. buses, taxis, you know, polluting vehicles that were not cleaner than Euro 4 standards were charged £10 daily for entering central London. That was about 27th of October, I think it was. Now, when research found that the ultra-low emission zone would improve air pollution, in 2019, they introduced the ultra-low emission zone, which meant that vehicles, you know, have to be Euro 6 standards. For example, for petrol vehicles, it was Euro 4 standards. For diesel vehicles, because diesel vehicles were the most or the more polluting vehicles compared to petrol. And when they introduced that, they also expanded the area to Greater London area, meaning that they covered South and North Circular Roads. For the first time, they, you know, expanded the clean air zone, which is called the ultra low emission zone. And eventually it was expanded to cover even greater areas, but it did not include the M25 area.
No, it didn't include the M25. Sounds familiar somehow, Ogo.
Yes, indeed. And they found much, you know, the results today show tremendous improvement. They looked at children's health, children whose lungs, you know, had stunted growth. They're finding now that some of them have, quite a number of them have recovered. And yeah. The mayor of London is very pleased, because at the outset, people thought it was going to take 200 years, you know, to achieve air pollution improvement in London. But since that implementation, it's taken 9 years to achieve it.
Which is phenomenal, isn't it?
Phenomenal. And, yeah, Londoners are really happy about it. Yeah.
And they expanded the ULEZ quite considerably, didn't they, 3 years ago, I think. And that was highly controversial, wasn't it? Because it encompassed just the whole of London.
It is. It's Greater London. It just covered the whole of London now. And that really is, again, that was controversial, but it's done the job, it's done the business.
Yeah, I mean, the important thing, I suppose, is for people to understand. A lot of people see it's controversial because it affects where they can drive, what they can drive, and what they have to pay. But actually, it is all about people's health, isn't it? Not just children's health, it's adults as well.
Yes, it's really about people's health. And people's lungs, well, children's lungs especially, were damaged and stunted. You know, pregnant women, for example, experienced challenges in terms of, you know, air pollution affecting the fetus and all that. Older people struggled, you know, with their breathing. You know, there were issues about breathing, you know, breathing complications and so forth. But with the air cleaned, a lot of that has reduced. You know, people are healthier, you know, live, you know, there are fewer, you know, lives, you know, cut short, for example. You know, number of deaths brought forward has much, much, much reduced. Children's lungs have improved, healthier children now. And research found that reductions in emergency hospital admissions among adults has also reduced. When previously, there used to be quite a lot of emergency, well, there's also, think about the cost associated with those emergency admissions to hospitals. I remembered here in Sheffield, we tried to do a research to find out the cost of improving admissions to hospitals. Unfortunately, we had challenges with some of the modeling results we we found. But yeah, you know, thinking about it logically, it made sense that if you can improve air pollution, then and you reduce admissions to hospital, you would also improve costs, hospital costs, you know?
Yeah.
So that was quite useful.
Yeah, it affects everybody, doesn't it? And the reason it affects, there was something very detailed in the press a few weeks ago about the issue, the research about children's lung development in London, where the ultra-low emission zone was, because they looked at children in the ultra-low emission zone and they had looked at children outside to see what the difference was. And, you know, it's an interesting point to say that the reason it affects children, air pollution in particular, or one of the groups it affects, is because children's lungs are still growing, aren't they?
That's correct.
So, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, children's lungs growth continues until about the age of about 20. So even though we think of, you know, young children 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, their lung is still growing up until the age of 18, 19 years old, you know, 20 years old. So if you think about it, if they're exposed to air pollution in all that time, then the lungs will be seriously damaged. In fact, if you remember the case of that young lady in London.
Yes, Ella Kissa, Deborah, yeah.
She died. You know?
Yes.
She had asthma, but because of poor air pollution in the area of London where she lived, south of London, she did not survive the asthma attack that eventually killed her, but it was because of poor air pollution that she had that experience. And that actually triggered more of an urgent need, you know, to improve air pollution in London. And I also remember that her case was the first recorded by the coroner that air pollution indeed contributed to her death.
Yes.
The first time that was ever acknowledged and recorded, you know, in a coroner's report. So that was quite a significant finding and a significant incident.
Yeah, that was the first time anywhere, wasn't it? And her mother really had to fight for that, didn't she?
She did. She spent a lot of time. She worked with lots of people. The researchers in University of London, I remember Professor Holgate as well, you know, confirming that, you know. So, yes, air pollution improvement has indeed helped a lot of people, especially young people.
Yeah, and I think people sometimes forget that, because I don't think we talk about it as much now, because obviously Sheffield's got a clean air zone, there's other cities have got clean air zones. It's sort of gone off the radar, but I think I'm right in, if I remember correctly from my days at work, that actually diesel fuel emissions are a class one carcinogen.
That's correct. That was established in 2012.
Which is shocking to think that's the same as tobacco smoking.
Yes, it's worse than tobacco smoking.
Worse.
Yeah. But tobacco smoking is also not good at all.
It's like a combination, isn't it, of chemicals?
Yeah. And that is why, if I steal the case, the challenge is to reduce pollution from diesel vehicles, especially from the buses and taxis, even the trains, you know, because they use diesel as fuel for transport. So yeah, diesel has never been a good, you know, good fuel for especially city area driving.
Yes, urban areas.
Urban areas, yes. On the motorway and all that, it's not too bad because economically it takes you further. It's cheaper economically on the long, you know, when you're on a long distance drive. But in urban environment or urban area driving, diesel is unfortunately not very good.
No, and that upsets a lot of people. When you think back, I still think that's quite shocking, because that's why it sticks in my mind, that we knew from 2012 the World Health Organization had classed diesel fuel emissions as a class one carcinogen, and yet nobody seemed to want to do much about it, did they?
Yeah, because there are interest groups as well.
Yeah, like the motorists all go, but yeah. But, yeah. You know, I remember around that time, things were coming out about the different, the Euro 6 engines or Euro 5 engines not doing what they said on the tin and things like that. But I also remember when laws came in to say you couldn't smoke at a bus stop. And I just remember thinking, it's very interesting because we were working on the low emission zone and what became our clean air zone. And I just thought, isn't that weird? We're not allowed to stand in a bus stop and inhale somebody else's smoke, but we can stand at the roadside in that bus shelter and all the vehicles and the diesel smell and everything's going past us.
That's right. I mean, if you remember, we covered a story where there was a study where the reporter stood by the roadside in central London for, is it about 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, they examined his blood before going to stand by the roadside. And they examined his blood after standing by the roadside, breathing in the air, the roadside air, basically, which is polluted air, actually. And by the time they examined his blood again, they saw black specks of, you know, particles that existed and had gone into his blood. In a space of, I think it was 10 minutes.
Yeah.
He stood by the roadside. But, you know, within 2 hours, that also cleared off when they looked at him again in 2 hours. But the important thing is that they identified that standing by the roadside for a very short period of time, you actually inhale and the air pollution, air pollutants actually get into your, you know, into your blood system, which did shock him because he didn't expect that that would be the case, but it was.
And that's part, you know, talk about nitrogen dioxide gases, is the thing that the clean air zones and ultra-low emission zones are there to tackle, aren't they? But that's what you're talking about there, that's particulate matter as well, isn't it?
That's right. If you improve or if you reduce the level of nitrogen dioxide in the air, you also end up reducing the level of particulate matter in the air as well, because they both come from the same types of fuel, diesel in the main, petrol as well, and this is why, you know, there's been tremendous push for people to change their vehicles into either hybrid electric vehicles or electric vehicles complete, you know, which we now see a huge, you know, growth in the purchase and use of electric vehicles around the place. And these vehicles are zero emission vehicles, except, of course, for the wear and tear that comes from, you know, clutch. Well, it's not clutch, sorry, the tire.
Yes.
You know, that's really now the source of pollution, and that contributes to particulate matter, or if you like, leaves particulate matter at the level it is, but it's much reduced in terms of tailpipe emissions of particulate matter. From the London studies, we've seen up to 24% reduction, and that is huge.
It's massive, isn't it? Massive.
When you think about NOx is short for nitric oxide plus nitrogen dioxide. Now, nitric oxide in air converts to nitrogen dioxide. And usually internal combustion systems tend to produce more nitric oxide from tailpipe emission. But in the air, in the environment where there's ozone is an oxidant, it converts nitric oxide to nitrogen dioxide. And that is where the problem really is. So a reduction in these tailpipe emissions means quite a lot, you know, in terms of the people's health. There's an impact on people's health.
Yeah, and brilliant. And before I let you go, I'll go, because we're going to run out of time in a minute, but let's just touch on this fallacy about, at one point, the government was promoting carbon. Diesel is a carbon, more carbon-friendly fuel, and that's all linked to climate change, because that's a greenhouse gas. Yeah. But of course, the pollutants we're talking about are local air pollutants, aren't they?
That's correct, yeah.
And that's where that differential comes from, doesn't it?
That's right. If you remember, I was saying earlier that on long-distance journeys, diesel is more efficient in terms of distance covered per volume of fuel. So because that was found, it meant that they thought, okay, since if you're driving long distance, you're using less fuel, therefore less carbon emissions. So that gave the impression that diesel is better for carbon reduction, which impacts, you know, climate change. But when you're in urban environment, air pollution becomes an issue for diesel.
Yeah, because it's exposure, isn't it? You know, on the motorway trip, you're generally doing long distance. Yeah. There's nobody really stood at the side of the road, is there? And generally, dare I say, it's not stop-start traffic.
Exactly.
But that's the difference, isn't it? So that's where that little idea that we were always told carbon and diesel were good, but when local air pollutants in urban areas like Sheffield, it's a big problem, isn't it?
That's correct.
Fascinating. Brilliant stuff, Ogo. We could talk for hours about this, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Ogo. And we'll speak to you again soon. I'll go. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have a rest of the weekend. Enjoy
you
yourself.
You too. Bye-bye, I'll go.
Bye.
And there's a temple that you see. I know you're gonna fall for it. And you know you're gonna take the risk, you know. You better you know, there's 100 million miles before you go, and there's a temple that you see, and I hope you're gonna fall for it.